Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 117 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here with you today. We've got a very, very special segment coming up, and it actually is the keynote for a series that we're going to be doing, an ongoing series on the program that we are introducing. You can find details at the blog, of course, the FDHLounge.blogspot.com. The series is being entitled the Bringing Back the USA series. What we've wanted to do for a long time, because this is the show where nothing is off topic, and I think we cover a broader range of material than any other talk show out there. For example, the most recent segment that we did last week with some of our FDH Lounge dignitaries was our Triple Crown preview segment. And today we're doing something completely different. But we've wanted a catch-all for some of our more serious segments that we're doing and some of the ones that are focused in areas of greater in-depth serious thought. And what we're celebrating in this series is a commitment to, on the one end, charitable means, charitable projects out there, such as, and we've got some examples of this up on the blog. Ziggy cartoonist Tom Wilson, when he was on the show talking about his cancer charity, he had Dominic Chianese, Uncle Junior from The Sopranos, talking about his foundation that brings musical entertainment to people who are in nursing homes and people who are shut in and confined and unable to get that kind of entertainment otherwise. But it also celebrates critical thinking in a couple of different areas, including public policy. And that's what we're talking about here today, because we also have up on the blog this one cited, this particular gentleman cited as an example of what we're talking about. So we're actually starting the series with him today, but I feel as though some of the segments that we've done with him previously have been a prototype, because when we're talking about critical thinking in public policy, innovative thinking in areas that are very, very important, that's kind of what the FDH Lounge Bringing Back the USA series is all about, in trying to encourage a sort of national revitalization in some of the areas that are most important to us. The couple of times we've had him on the show previously, he has really delivered, as I know he will today. He is one of the foremost experts out there, I believe, on the subject of the federal debt and the dangers that it poses to America. But it's very interesting. He is from a family that is very interesting and talented in a number of different ways, but not least of which, all you have to do is go back to the last time he was on the show, and before we were talking about any of the areas that we were going to ask him about, he actually was catching us up on things going on with his very talented daughter, Cara DioGuardi, author of A Hell of a High Note, Surviving Life, Love, and American Idol. So he enjoys talking about things going on with her, and I'm sure we'll get to a catch-up on that, as well as the very serious topics that he has been continuing to educate us on. He was, of course, the first practicing CPA elected to the U.S. Congress and put in a position to be able to go in there and try to make things happen. He participated in the federal bailout of the S&L industry through Anderson Accounting, as far as helping to administer that, as well as previous to that, the bailout of New York City. So he has a lot of experience. He's been an author a couple of different times over on this subject. I can only be speaking of, as I say, in terms of public policy, one of our favorite guests on the show, if not our favorite, former Congressman Joe DioGuardi. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you on, sir. Welcome back to the FDH Lounge.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for that nice introduction. I appreciate it. And there's a lot to talk about when you want to talk about what's going on in America and Europe today. And I'd be very happy to get into some of my thinking. You call it creative. And I think that's important, because you have to think outside the box these days on solutions, because what you see in Washington is total gridlock. And what you're seeing in the economy is now stagnation, and you need to start looking at solutions that are beyond the conventional. And that's what I try to do because, you know, you can't – I think of the Titanic. Why? This is the 100th anniversary. I was just up giving a speech at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada, and I didn't know that that's where the bulk of the bodies came from. It came back to until I was there that weekend on the 100th anniversary, and they said that the cemetery was, you know, not too far from the hotel, and I decided to go there to see these gravestones. But the analogy I want to make is that the Titanic didn't go down because of what it saw. It went down because of what it didn't see. And that's what America is today. We're like a big ship of state. And there's an iceberg in front of us. And what we see is $15 to $16 trillion. That's the treasury bills that we keep talking about when we have to raise the national debt ceiling. But what we don't see, if we had the right accounting system, that we could see is everything that's off the books below the water. And that's the, you know, unfunded liabilities, in fact, unrecorded liabilities for what we owe on a present value basis using actuaries. So these are not invented numbers, and we know the numbers, what we owe for Social Security, Medicare, the federal civil service pension system, the military pension system, what we owe for all these federal enterprises that we call government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the post office, there's about 20 of them. Why do I say, oh, because believe it or not, they are supposed to be self-sufficient, and that's why we gave them the full faith and credit of the United States of America so that they can borrow at much less than anybody else. But guess what? Now we're having to pay on some of those guarantees. Well, if you're a bank and you're a company that is subject to the Securities and Exchange Commission because you took public money for stocks or bonds, you need to use something called generally accepted accounting principles, the accrual basis. And you need to estimate annually what your losses are. You don't wait until there's the bailout and go for a big number like we did with the S&L crisis in 1987, $500 billion. Banks have to estimate every year, based on their experience, what do we think we're not going to collect? What do we think those guarantees could cost us? It's like what they call in business an allowance for bad debts. You don't wait until the receivables go bad. You need to estimate what you think, based on your experience in the past, you're not going to collect. We don't do that in the United States. So therefore, we talk about just the $15 trillion going on $16 trillion by the end of this year, because we know we're going to have another debt ceiling vote coming up probably just after the presidential election, and that's where we are. Now, I could talk about this a lot, but I was really gratified to see Senator Coburn. He is a physician who went to the U.S. Senate, and he self-imposed term limits on himself, so he's not running. And you know what he's putting out as a book? In fact, he announced it on the public broadcasting system on TV, a book called The Debt Bomb. You know what my speeches have been lately at the Wharton School, the graduate school, and others? The fiscal unsustainability of the West, the global debt bomb. So he's right on the page with me. But even better than that, as he's being interviewed by the good people on Channel 13, public television here in New York, he says, you know, one of our problems, we don't use generally accepted accounting principles, and that's why we really don't know what the real national debt is. And he went on to say, you know, if you use them, I got some estimates that it's well over $100 trillion. I'm saying basically it's about $60 trillion. He's telling me, and he may know a lot more than me, it's over $100 trillion. So you want to talk about public policy? We need to understand where we are before we can decide on how to fix where we're going, to fix things so we can get to where we're going and keep the United States in the number one position as the economic power, superpower of the world. You know, you can't maintain your military might unless you have your economic might. China now is catching up on us. They're building aircraft carriers and submarines. They don't have a system where they have to, you know, wait to do things. They have a system they control totally, so when they want to do something, they do it. Now, we don't want that system because that's communism. But our system now is becoming so cumbersome that we have total political gridlock in Washington. We have the two political extremes, you know, controlling the situation so that nothing can get done. And we have to wait this year for a presidential election in order to do anything. And this is the third year this great country, this great fiscal entity called the United States of America, has not had a budget. Imagine that. If you don't have a plan, and that's what a budget is, how do you know where you're going? So what they do is they limp along. I could talk about that forever, but go ahead, Rick. Ask me some good questions.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that's a disgraceful thing with the budget, Joe. I was just agreeing with you on that. And as far as an excellent summation on your part, as you've given us previously, as far as the nature of the problem and the things that need to be done, as far as the road to hear from there and some of the people who might be useful in getting that done. You mentioned Tom Coburn, and of course, yeah, he's doing an excellent job of educating the public on these issues, and he's taken some slings and arrows from the Grover Norquists of the world who don't appreciate the notion that revenue is going to have to be part of the solution in the end. I'm also focused on your friend Ron Paul, who has campaigned for you previously and who is making a very notable run for president at the moment here. There's a lot of folks who are looking at this and are looking at the long game here that his son Rand, and I would be very heartened at this notion, might be a future candidate for president down the road, somebody poised to maybe pick up the movement and advance it in the future. What are you seeing from the Paul family, both short-term and long-term, from your perspective? Because they're some of the most noteworthy folks out there on the scene today who are advocating what you're talking about.
Well, I see people, especially Ron, that can energize the young people in America. It is great when you go to these sessions where he's speaking, and I've been to several in New York, and there was a rally in front of City Hall in New York called Audit the Fed, and I spoke at that rally, and I said, yes, Ron, we got to audit the Fed, but we got to use external auditors. We can't use government accountants to audit. We need true audits so that we know what the numbers are and we can trust them. What Ron and Rand, I don't know Rand well, but he seems to be in the same mold as his dad, they are doing a great service by educating us about what's going on with the monetary policy. There's been so little said about that in any debates for the presidency, and people know very little about monetary policy, the gold standard, and what this means. Now, just to break it down simply, there are two major things that we use to determine the health of our economy. One is fiscal policy, and what's that? That is what Congress basically does with taxing and spending, okay? That's fiscal policy, that's the budget, that's raising the debt ceiling. Even though they're using the wrong numbers, that's basically what fiscal policy is. Now, the other side of it is the money supply. It's monetary policy. It's the interest rates. Now, we should be using them both, especially at a time like this, but what's happened is our fiscal policy is non-existent. We haven't had a budget. We have all kinds of political gridlock. Nobody wants to talk about the real solution. Some part of the Congress doesn't want to talk about taxes. The other part doesn't want to talk about entitlements, and nobody can meet somewhere in the middle. They've thrown out all the sensible approaches by, you know, the Bowles and Erskine Commission. That's the, I guess, what we call the Debt Commission for short. They've thrown out the sensible, you know, the super committee dealings, and they've thrown out the group of six. So we're nowhere. So what happens then is the Fed's got to step in because we don't want to go back to another recession, and we certainly don't want to go to a depression. But what they've done is they've artificially created the cost of money, because now the interest costs are not determined by the market, and Ron Paul would agree with this 100%, they're being determined by quantitative easing by the Fed. Now, we need that for a while because our fiscal policy is not working. So we need now to have loose or easy money so that we continue to stay out of a major recession or depression by keeping people working. But, you know, there's going to be a time when interest rates are going to go back, because we know inflation's going to come back. We know we've got a, you know, the dollar is getting weaker. But when interest rates come back, that's the fuse on the bomb, because right now we've never had interest rates this low. You know, public borrowing right now is under 2%, and that's on 10-year bonds. What happens when interest rates go back to the normal range, 6, 7, 8%? God forbid they go back to where they were under Jimmy Carter with stagflation, stagnant economy and inflation. That was 21% prime rate. So the point is, if it goes back to 6%, then you're talking about 6% of what? You're talking about now even the Obama administration projecting that the debt on the books is likely to go in 10 years to $25 trillion. You're talking about real money. Now you're talking about interest of well over $1 trillion that, you know, could sink America, because it's going to replace all of our discretionary money. And where do we go from there? So we need to start bending this debt curve down. And the Federal Reserve doesn't at this point know when to make a move to stop quantitative easing, to get interest rates set by the marketplace, because it's afraid that if they stop that without having a sound fiscal policy and a new president, or at least a presidential election bias, that they will just keep everybody in uncertainty and prepare the way for much more inflation later on, and that would then mean a lot more interest later on. So Ron Paul is one that's talking about that. He goes even further, talking about the fact that we've now taken our money standard from the gold standard down to paper, and what the Fed is doing right now is in many ways a joke, just printing money and more money and printing it just to stay out of a deep recession or depression. But where is that leading us? We don't know. We are in uncharted waters. This is the problem. I'm mainly concerned with the fiscal side, because I know that we're not disclosing to the public what we're really spending. But we also have a problem with the Fed, because they're not a transparent organization. It's like a black box. That's why Ron Paul is calling for auditing the Fed. We want to know the full amount of that balance sheet. Some say it could be well over $10 trillion, and a lot of that money has been lent to foreigners. So, you know, I like Ron and Rand because they're pushing the envelope on the discussion for monetary policy and what the Federal Reserve System is all about and whether or not things have to be changed. Now, do I want to see the Fed eliminated? I say right now, God forbid, because you know who would have to take over? The United States Congress. And they are totally incompetent and totally unable to deal with fiscal policy. Can you imagine them then politicizing monetary policy? It would be a disaster.
Yeah, that would be. And it's interesting, Joe, in talking to you, because I know that you're clearly the guy who much prefers discussing policy to politics and that kind of business. But there's something that happened political this week that I want to get your thoughts on, because it just seems to kind of sum up the no-win situation that we seem to be in. And that would be the defeat in the primary in Indiana of Senator Richard Lugar. Now, I have to tell you, putting my cards on the table, in a vacuum, I generally applaud the more conservative candidate winning a primary. Don't really have a problem with that. But it's one of these things where, and I get that maybe he's been too much of an insider, and there's been that critique. He didn't even live in Indiana towards the end. But the new guy coming in, Richard Murdoch, talking about everything that really just promises more gridlock, it seems, next year. Well, we'll get things done. We'll bend the other side to our will. No compromise on anything here. And we've talked about this previously on the show with some of our panelists. When you're talking about some of those deals out there that include something like $10 in spending cuts for every $1 of a tax increase, if verifiable, what would be wrong with something like that? That just kind of sends a chill up my spine that you know, even when you're getting somebody in there who's not as much of an insider, somebody who's coming in from an outside perspective, that they're married to this kind of thought process that doesn't seem to move the ball forward. And that seems to be the double-edged sword of the Tea Party these days.
And I don't really know the gentleman. I know he won the primary, but we have an insurance policy there, Rick, and it's the governor. Mitch Daniels is one of the most thoughtful conservatives that I've known. I knew him when I was a congressman. When I wrote the first book, Unaccountable Congress, It Doesn't Add Up, He was nice enough to write a wonderful review in the Heritage Insider in those days. He was part of the Heritage Foundation. He understands, you know, the need for fiscal responsibility and financial accountability and using the right accounting system. My feeling is that he's going to play a useful role with that new senator. And but if I had to, you know, talk about the new senator, I'd be talking blind because I really haven't heard what he's been saying. Now, you're telling me that he's got some formulas right now that he's playing with, and I don't know whether or not those are formulas that would work or not. The 1 in 10, that doesn't seem workable to me. I think we got to go back to what the Simpson-Bowles Commission was talking about, that it's got to be a much better balance than that, and everything's got to be on the table. You can't just talk about raising taxes without putting everything on the table. And you can't talk about raising taxes without talking about tax reform, because we know we have a tax system that is complicated, that's not fair, that gives away over $1 trillion in what they call tax credits and deductions. These are called tax expenditures. And we need to reduce the tax rates by eliminating much of those. And we need to bring back some of that money that's being stored offshore back to America by lowering taxes. And I think that money then would be productive here. We see manufacturing starting to, you know, increase in America. We need more of that money back here for the plant and equipment and the technology we need to become productive once more. So I would hope that senator would be listening to Mitch Daniels and listening to, you know, what people have said already in terms of a real balance. 10 to 1
exactly.
To me doesn't seem that much of a balance.
Well, Joe, to be clear, what I was saying there, just so you understand, it was not that gentleman that was pushing the 10 to 1 thing here. But I guess what I'm talking about in general is you have on the one side, it seems like, the establishment, the insiders that have been there forever, K Street, you know, sucking up to the lobbyists and the big banks. You have that on the one side, and on the other side you have the folks that I really appreciate, and a lot of people do, the Tea Party, the outsiders,
right.
But I'm troubled by the inflexibility I'm seeing from a lot of the Tea Party people, and I guess I use him as an example of this because the kind of common sense things you're talking about, I got to be honest with you, a lot of Tea Party people would be screaming sellout at that, as opposed to looking at it in a sober kind of a manner and saying, hey, you know, what can we do here to actually improve things? Because more of the status quo, more gridlock, I would think would be unacceptable to everybody. But I guess that's what I'm talking about. You have a dynamic where it seems like, you know, you lose either way, whether it be with the insiders who aren't going to fix things or the outsiders who are coming in with energy but maybe misdirected as far as their passion and maybe a little bit of extremism from time to time.
Rick, I got it, and you're right. And the problem with the Tea Party, and I respect the people who want to see a fiscally sound America, an America that is a small government America, not a big plantation America. I'm a fiscal conservative, but I'm a small government conservative. I don't want to see the federal government doing what the state should be doing. Now, I know there are things that only the federal government can do, but and I had to go through this. Don't forget I ran for the U.S. Senate, and I gave my speeches, and I tried to make common sense, and I was shouted down by a lot of Tea Party, but I got supported by a lot of Tea Party because they realized that I was making sense and I was on the inside and I am a certified public accountant, not a political hack. Now, the real problem you have is the political system. The reason why you're getting that response from the Tea Party is they're afraid to lose their primaries. And there is a sort of Damocles over their head because many of them got elected with that kind of Tea Party support at a time when people were feeling real pain. Don't forget. We brought in a lot of Republicans because of the mess of the economy. Now, the economy is getting somewhat better, and the freshmen that got elected by the Tea Parties are afraid to make any move until after this next election because they know that these Tea Parties can then find another more, let's say, conservative or right-wing extreme Republican to take their place. That's not going to be good for America, but they know that that's there. The problem is the system, Rick. The political system is not working. You know, first of all, why do we have to wait a whole year to see a president elected to do anything? Why don't we have just one term for president, 6 years? Let me start talking outside the box. Why do we need, you know, 2 years in the House? It should be 4. So my feeling is you need 2 terms for the Senate, 6 years each, three terms for the House, 4 years each. That's the term limits. Let's recycle the people in America, get some new blood, new ideas in there, and one term for president at 6 years, not 2 4-year terms. That would start getting some of the money that's poisoned the process out, because the consultants love it. The more campaigns you have, the more polls you need, the more ads you need, and they get that 15% on the ads. So that's now become the biggest lobby in town to keep the status quo. But my feeling is, to really get things moving in America, to get the right planning, we need to change the way we elect people, because we don't have the best people in office around America, and yet we are depending on them to spend trillions of dollars at every level of government. So, you know, like me, I'm a CPA. I went to Congress. Where are the rest of America? Why do we have, you know, 60% of Congress being attorneys? Now, I know it's the legislative process, but I think we need more physicians like Senator Coburn, more CPAs like Joe DiGuardi. So we need more Americans to see this as maybe a second career as they get into their 50s and 60s to change the way Congress thinks.
Very well said, Joe. No question about that. We got about 90 seconds here. Just as you did the last time, anything you want to get in as far as plugs for Kara, as far as her book or any other projects going on?
Well, you know, it's funny. I saw an email from Kara. They're putting her book in paperback now, believe it or not.
Ooh.
And I sent her an email. I said, well, you know, since it's in paperback, I assume they're going to be now publishing it in some foreign languages. And don't forget, Carrie, your dad did a lot for the Albanian people, created that new state, Kosovo, and they love you, and they love the DiGuardi name. Can you get the rights to do it in Albanian? I'm sure your publisher, Harper Collins, is not going to even think about publishing it in Albanian. So he says, Dad, that's a neat idea. That's a market they probably hadn't thought of, because your name is famous all over the Balkans because of what you did to get rid of that neo-Nazi Milosevic as he was starting wars in Croatia, Slovenia, and then Bosnia, the Srebrenica. So she's working on that right now. Hey, Kara is wonderful. You know, she calls me about 2 weeks ago from Nashville. I said, Kara, what are you doing in Nashville? Dad, I spend a lot of time here. I'm now becoming one of the sought-after writers for country music. I said, Kara, you're unbelievable. That's great. Keep it going. Keep that DiGuardi name going.
Nice. Taking it to all different places, all different genres. That's always great to know. Joe, I want to thank you for the great talk, as always, my friend. Always entertaining content for the FDH Lounge listeners. Definitely got to catch up with you again while the campaign is still ongoing this year, as we talk about America's most important issues.
Tell your audience to look at truthingovernment.org if they want to see my most recent speeches at the graduate school at Wharton. I spoke to the college Republicans at Wagner College 2 weeks ago in Staten Island, and they can see me in, you know, full color and what I'm saying.
Excellent. God bless, Joe. These are the things people need to know and be talking about. Thank you so much. We look forward to doing it again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Appreciate it as always, Joe. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Mini episode number 117 of the FDH Lounge.